Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Welcome you to Edu All-Stars. This is our sixth episode, so we are really excited today to have Adam Bello here with us today. He is the founder and president of EduTecher and EduClipper. He's just coming off an excellent keynote address at the ISTE 2013 conference in San Antonio this year. He works with educational leaders, teachers, and students from around the United States to help them infuse technology successfully in the classroom. And we're really excited to have him with us today. And the other hosts I have with me are...
I'm Stacey Huffine, otherwise known as Tech Ninja Stacey on Twitter. And I just want to thank everybody for the great ratings and the feedback that we've been getting on iTunes. Because of all of that, you know, we're one of the top-rated podcasts in the K-12 category on iTunes. And just want to encourage everybody to keep giving us that feedback and rating it when you're watching them.
Hey, my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. Kessler has one S in it. And Adam, we just want to thank you again for joining us, taking some time out of your evening to speak with us. Yeah. So, Adam, what's your Twitter handle so people can follow you if they aren't already?
Sure. So it's my personal one is at Adam Bello, ADAMBELLOW. And then you can follow my sites at EduTecher and EduClipper.
Cool. Awesome. Well, let's get going. So first question we have, we kind of like to delve way back when. So they're kind of a million career paths you could have chosen, and you ended up in education. How did you make that choice, or how did you end up there? I don't know if it was a choice for you.
Well, it was originally a choice not to be an educator. you know how that works, right?
Yeah.
I try to get out, and they pull me back in. My parents were both teachers, and I remember as a kid, for whatever reason, I was just like, oh, I want to be like a filmmaker. I really was just, that's what I wanted to do. Love movies, always have. And I realized after getting out of film school that might not have been the best career path. And I fell in love and got engaged, and my fiance at the time, my wife now, basically we decided that I needed a job, you know? It's good to have dreams and ambitions, but you need to make some money. So I was like, oh, well, I love kids. We worked at summer camps for years. So I decided I would go into the classroom and got a job as an assistant English teacher at a school for kids with language-based learning disabilities. And that was it. I fell in love with it. I was like, this is wonderful. I'm just really enjoyed doing it. And did it for a while.
Now, how long have you been teaching?
So I'm not in the classroom anymore. I taught high school English for 6 years. And after that, I was a technology training specialist in a school district, so I was teacher on special assignment for 3 years. And then beyond that, I was a technology director for 18 schools for about 2 years.
Now, can you remember back to some of your first experiences with integrating technology into the classroom since you've been in the classroom for a little while? What were some of the first things that you implemented, and how did it go?
Dial-up.
Yeah, no, it's not dial-up. I mean, that's why I remember dial-up when I was a student. Don't let the bald fool you, my they're fairly young. I remember doing a couple of things really well and then a couple of things not so well. So the first thing that I really remember was the arrival of this large piece of hardware my first year teaching. It was a whiteboard, and you guys are knowing where I'm going with this. It was a big, giant whiteboard and a giant cart that I knew had a Mac Pro in it somehow and a projector. And it was a smart board, and this was like 2003, I guess. Mm-hmm. And no one trained us, no one told us what it was. So we were like, oh, it's a whiteboard. So we took the whiteboard and we dragged it around and used it elsewhere on the sphere and as a whiteboard, just writing on it. And then we used the cart with the projector in it to play bootleg movies and watch them as a staff. We would watch movies like Shaun of the Dead and stuff like that but on a big screen. So... you know, that was my first realization of like, oh, something is wrong with training. You know, like we need to use this technology better. So that was something that I don't think anyone did well at that school at the time. And then something that we did right was that same year, using the film background that I had, the passion in film, I had a great co-teacher who was really the lead teacher. I was the assistant. And we made films with our students. You know, we edited them in iMovie and, it was an amazing, amazing thing using these little old Emacs, if you guys remember those, like little triangle Emacs. But we used, technology that way to tell stories.
When did you decide or realize that it was time to leave the classroom, or was that an opportunity that came up for you?
Yeah, you know what? I had started EduTeker in 2007, and then it was the same year that that there was a job opening in Long, you know, where I lived. It was like 20 minutes from where I lived, for a school district where I could help 400 teachers across K-12 infuse technology. So I'd still be working with kids. I'd still be working with teachers. And in my head, like, any move I've made in my career has always been, like, can I impact more people in a more profound way? So impacting 30 kids in a classroom, or really, I was a high school teacher, so I had, like, between 100 and 150 kids each year. 400 teachers that are able to impact thousands of kids sound very attractive to me. So that's when I decided I would leave the classroom. But I was still a teacher on special assignments, so I still did a lot of work with the kids as well.
So it looks like a few years ago you started the website EduTeker. So what kind of was the inspiration behind that? And, you know, or is that still utilized today? You guys still do that often, right? I mean, it's still a resource today, correct?
Oh, yeah. Very much still used. It's, you know, I'm surprised at how much it's used sometimes. It's just like, you know, there's so many other places out there that have done similar things in the last year or so even, and do it well. You know, people are like, oh, are you afraid there's competitors? I'm like, no, I'm sharing resources that are free for teachers. Like, as many people that want to do that should do that. Like, it's a good thing.
Absolutely.
What's the premise behind it for those people that don't know?
So the premise was, it was founded in 2007. I was teaching at a graduate school, and the original reason I did it was because I wasn't remembering all the things I was finding. So I put together this kind of list, but I like the arts, and I consider myself somewhat creative, so I was like, oh, I'll just make it into a website. And, you know, I've said this before, I've used iWeb, which was a huge mistake later on, but, you know, at the time I used that, and, you know, the concept was that it was founded on the premise that it would always be free, and it would never have ads. And the reason it was, because if you guys could think back to 2007, I don't know if you remember this, but there were a couple of sites that were very popular that were charging $20 a year subscription to teachers to find free resources, and they had ads all over them. Wow. And I just found that personally, like, offensive from a teacher standpoint. So I decided to build my own thing and worked on it very, very hard for a long time, and, you know, created this custom social network piece to it, and, like, have done a lot of changes over the years to it.
Do you find that students use EduTeker also, or is it just really a teacher resource?
I mean, I think it's primarily a teacher resource. I'm sure there are some students that find stuff on it. Like, I know my niece has used it. You know, she looks on, you know, and she finds, like, all the arts programs. I'm sure there are kids that use it, but it's primarily intended for teacher use.
I've always thought there was a market out there, and this may exist somewhere, for some kind of website that when a student or when a teacher is doing, like, student-based learning, and they want you to create a project, say, over the elements, okay, and then the student has to go out there and go to this website and find different ways that they can go do this, because I think that's one of the things is they don't have a benchmark on what can be done. And I thought that something that actually was developed, you know, with all these different resources that are out there, that students can go, oh, this looks really cool, and then go out and do that. I don't know if that exists or not, but I think it's a really cool idea.
I mean, to some extent, my other project that I'm working on is can be utilized in that way.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get into it for sure.
Yeah.
Well, along the lines of EduTeker, I mean, I know you recently teamed up with Steve Dimbo to write a book about technology in the classroom, and a lot of people have been talking about how much they really enjoy it. I read another review yesterday from somebody who's using it. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about? And we're going to make sure that on our eduallstars.com, we'll link to your book as well so people can find it.
Awesome.
So can you tell us a little more about it?
Yeah, sure. So Steve Dimbo famously, you know, just one of the early pioneers of web tools and sharing. You know, I've been a big fan of his for a long time. And in 2011, we were just talking actually at ISTE, and I said to him, I said, you know, we should do something together. And at the time, I was talking about some features for EduTeker, and I was like, maybe it would be interesting to get your insight on this. And then we came along with the idea that, I don't know how we came up with it, but we were like, oh, we should write a book, but our book would be totally different. And, like, we had crazy ideas. Like, it'll be a book about web tools, but in the back there'll be stickers of tombstones, and we'll put tombstones on the tools that you know, that disappear. it's still an idea we're thinking of for later. But we really we talked about the fact that one of the challenges we faced is that teachers, they don't know all of the tools because they, you know, if you're into technology, you might have just gotten into it and you're only learning about the new cutting-edge tools. But there's other tools that have real reasons that they're around and reasons that they've lasted 6-7 years. So we decided to take like our favorite tools that have either maintained the course of time or some that are newer that we just think have a lot of potential and really give a deep dive into the pedagogical rationale behind it, ways to use it, stretch ideas to like get, you know, take it the idea further once you've tried it for a few minutes, and incorporate our communities, our PLNs. So there's tons of quotes from, you know, tons of people on Twitter, 3 or 4 per chapter, about why that tool is useful to them or what they would do with the tool. So it's really, there's a very, real premise grounded in the community behind it. And we worked on it we thought about the idea for like a year, and then we built it out and wrote it in the last year. And there's a website component to it as well where there's tutorials and you could build a community around it because we wanted it to be, you know, we know writing a book about tools is almost silly. You know, it only begs for volume 2 and 3, and obviously we're working on that stuff as well. But the community piece of it is really a great place where you can ask questions like, this didn't work well for my third grade. How do you change it? And then have other teachers that have used it or have us comment on those types of things.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's one thing that sticks out to me about your book is that it's not just a book that lists some tools to use in your classroom. I mean, there's so many books that are out there like that, but there is that piece where you sought out people on Twitter and how they're using things and quotes from them. And I like for me, that's the reason I'm on Twitter, is for that community to learn and see how they're using things and learning things. And I love that you incorporated that into the novel.
Yeah, we wanted it to be fun. I mean, honestly, like, the chapters are relatively short, they're digestible in a short period of time, and, you know, like, I've designed it to look like a browser, and Steve and I had this idea where we're like, oh, we'll make it look like a web browser, and the whole book looks like a browser. so we wanted it to be very accessible, and it's not intended for people like, you know, Richard Byrne would not buy this book to read and learn about the tools, right? Because he's, you know, he knows them all, you know? but, on the other hand, teachers that we are brought into the workshops for would be perfect, you know, audiences. This is a great book to give to, like, you know, staff members starting a new school or, like, you know, just having reference for the teachers in your school that might just be dipping their toes in the water, so to speak.
That's great. Okay, I just have to say I was part of the hashtag not at ISTE calling group.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Todd got to go, of course. Chris and I did not. You know, but I was following along and so jealous, you know, watching all of the tweets and everything going on during your keynote. And as soon as it went onto YouTube, you know, I had to watch it and just have to say it was absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
Very, very inspiring. Kind of tell us about the process, you know, when they asked you to do that and kind of your thought process of how you were going to present all of that.
Sure. So, you know, it's one of those things that, like, secretly I was like, I've always wanted to do that. Even, like, from my first ISTE, I was like, oh, my God, it'd be so cool to just address all these amazing educators. but when the call came, I was like, whoa, that's terrifying. Like, I remember I was really nervous and scared.
Did you freak out when you got the call, though?
You know what? I didn't understand. I got an email first. The email was like, can you talk tomorrow about the conference? And I was like, I wondered what it was. I knew it wasn't up for an award. Maybe they want me to do, like, the Mario Armstrong, like, opening thing, because I've done that at certain conferences, like FETC, I've done, like, the MC thing. So when I talked to them, and they're like, oh, we'd like to do the keynote, I literally was like, what do you mean? Like, do you need to do, like, an opening act? Am I supposed to do, like, 10 minutes before? Because I had once given, like, when I won an award one year, they asked me to do, like, a 5-minute speech beforehand. So I was like, maybe it's like that at the keynote. But when it sunk in, like, literally that day, I was flying home from Florida. We were on a family vacation. And, like, just the wheels are turning. And the next morning, I started, like, gathering slides. So, you know, the joke about the slides is that there was probably 600 or so that didn't make it into the presentation.
Oh, wow.
Seriously, like, there's a deck. I should just throw them out there. And they're random. Like, they're just random, like, crazy numbers of slides that just have nothing to do with anything except I thought it was an idea that I was going to follow. And the process really was, for the first 2 or 3 months, I crafted this, like, mega deck of just stuff. And it got very overwhelming for me, to be honest with you, because I was trying to find, like, what did I want to say? You know, I have this amazing platform or opportunity to speak to people that I'm so enamored of in terms of both the community and the work that they do. What do I say to them? You know, like, what do I say? So one day I actually printed out every single page, like literally 900 or so slides, and went through them, put them all out on my floor. It actually took many, many rotations of the floor and the bed. I'm not even kidding. With a broom, so I could point to them and kind of make a storyboard almost, and literally put them into place and then reloaded the deck. And it sounds archaic and crazy, but it was very helpful, actually. And it was at that moment where I was like, oh, this is it. This is the flow. This is the idea. And it probably took, no joke, 300-400 hours. No exaggeration. Yeah.
Now, are you one that you write a speech and then you practice? Because, like, when you were up there, it seemed so conversational, but you have to have some kind of practice with all those slides that you have going.
Yeah, you know what? You spend so much time. Some of those slides, like there's one slide, you know, I'm sure people remember it, but there's one slide where, like, it's a sponge and it zooms out and it's a face, and then there's water pouring on top of it with all these, like, logos popping up. You know, that took me, like, 7 or 8 hours just to do that one slide. And it's wow. Probably on screen for maybe 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. But because I was so, like, aware of what was on the slide and what I wanted it to represent, I didn't have to practice it. I mean, I probably rehearsed it maybe 10 times, which is not a tremendous amount, you know, for something like that. But I had spent so much time with it that I really didn't do a speech for it. I did write out pieces of speeches, like pieces of things, and I guarantee you that they're way off from what I said, but there's, like, a hint of, you know, the kernel of the idea there. In the past, I have used a speech or a piece of writing. Like one of the other presentations I gave called The Ten Commandments was based on a paper that I wrote. And I wrote the paper, and if you read the paper and then watch the presentation, it's very much a literal translation of, like, the ideas expressed in writing as this new medium. But this time around, it was, you know, this kind of free flow, and I'm glad it came off as being practiced and not rambling. But
well, and you present all the time. Were you scared or nervous at all?
Yes, yes. I mean, first of all, I always am a little nervous, even if it's something I've done before. I try not to do the same presentation over and over and over again. Although, like, it's harder the more you get asked to do it, because especially when they take 6 months to make, it's not like I could just be like, oh, wait a year and a half, and I'll be back to you.
Yeah.
But no, I was definitely nervous because a lot of the material was completely brand new. I had no idea if it would land well or not. You know, if people would think the jokes were funny, if people would think the content was valid enough. And, you know, my biggest concern was that it come off as genuine. Because the topic is, you know, is these charged to me when they talked to me originally? It was like, we don't want you to be controversial. We want you to inspire people. And I'm like, that's a very hard, tall order. To tell someone that you're going to inspire a room of thousands of educators, like, especially those educators, you know, like, it's you guys, yeah. Right? It's people that are inspired already. So for me, that was the big challenge. But I'm glad it was received the way it was.
Well, you know, and yeah. One thing that I think was a little bit different too is, you know, sometimes we have these keynote speakers who are so much larger than life, and people just go in and then they just tweet these great things about them as they're speaking. But, you know, one thing that I think was a little bit different with you is there was all this. You know, you're so approachable that there was all this love from your Twitter people. I mean, even before you got on the stage, are people just wishing you well, wanting you to do well? And, you know, I think that, to me, that was like a little different thing for me to see, because, you know, with some of the other keynote speakers we see, we don't see that all the time because they don't have those relationships sometimes necessarily online.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I have to say, like, I have great friends, and they're not just like Twitter friends. Like, these are people that, like, when we see each other, it's like there is this deep connection and respect. And, you know, I have great respect for the people, even in the audience that I don't know, but that I've read tweets or blogs, and, like, I really genuinely feel a sense of community amongst everybody. So, you know, I'm glad that that came off that way, and it was nice. Like, I got up there, and there were people holding up iPads, like friends, and then, like, people sitting next to them, go at them, or, you know. I don't know, for Secretary of Education or some weird stuff like that. You know, it did make me feel at ease, I guess. But yeah, I got to tell you, it was a little scary because that room was insane. That room was just like the longest room. I timed myself. It took me like 2 minutes to walk from front to back, which was, I was like, this is a lot of people.
How many people were actually at that at that speech.
You know, I've heard mixed numbers. From what I was told from ISTE that day, they said that they had 6,000 of the 7,000 seats filled.
Yeah.
And there were probably, and there had to have been at least 500 people watching it in different like remote areas because they had like different streams going on. And
that was the largest group to speak in front of?
That is the largest group I've spoken in front of. I've done like 4,000 people, you know, like but 6,000 for, and also just the venue itself. It's like it's the closing keynote of this year. I was definitely like, oh my god,
you were the last thing we were all gonna hear before we went home.
Yeah, well, I said to ISTE, I said, you know, if I mess this up, I guess you won't have me back next year.
Well, you know, it was funny because I had to leave early from ISTE on Wednesday to drive to somewhere else where I had to present, and I'm driving down the road, and I was trying to look at a couple of the tweets. I mean, it was just going crazy during your presentation, just people sharing all these things you were saying.
And then Todd's tweets went crazy because everyone was telling him, oh, my God, you were mentioned.
That's right.
Talk about a freak-out moment. I had to pull the car over. My phone was just buzzing crazy, and I pulled the car over, and I was like, what is going on? And then I was looking, I was like, oh, my gosh, why am I not there live? I could have just gotten into town at like midnight that night. And so that was, to me, seriously, that was one of the coolest moments to because you and I had never met before ISTE.
That's right.
And so to see, I mean, and you mentioned lots of really cool moments of things that you had seen, not just my thing. But for me, I was like, oh my gosh, that really, because I went home and a couple days later, I wrote a blog about your voice mattering. Because seeing that something that I wrote a few months ago, you had seen and then you included in a keynote, it was like, wow, people are really reading things that I'm writing online, and I really do have a voice that some people listen to. And I mean, it was really empowering for me just to know that somebody, I mean, of your, that you, I mean, you have so many people you follow and follow you on Twitter. I mean, it was cool to me.
But I appreciate it. But honestly, like, it was my pleasure to have the stage shared with so many people. Like, I mean, I think I mentioned somewhere around 30 different teachers, students or something like that. And it was very intentional. Like, the idea was not to be, like, it's not a me show. Like, the stuff I've done, yeah, I'm happy. Like, I'm proud of what I've done. Some of the stuff I'm not so proud of, you know, whatever. But, like, there's so many people doing awesome stuff. And, like, I have to tell you that your quote in that article, like, that line about how this was the happiest moment and this, you're so proud of your kids. Like, for me, that's what makes me miss education, like the teaching perspective of it. And it's also something that needs to be shared. Like, that type of stuff where you take a risk and decide to do something that's either, you know, not to be funny with my choice of words, but, like, outside the box based on the kid that did the In-N-Out.
Jack in the Box.
Yeah, Jack in the Box, there you go. So, you know, the idea really is to share that type of bravery and feelings with other teachers, because I'm not the one necessarily going to be reading it all the time, but there are other teachers that hopefully are reading it and taking that to heart and saying, look, I could do the same thing. It didn't, you know, it doesn't take much. And it made a huge difference. It was probably one of the biggest moments of your year doing that project.
Oh, biggest moment of my career was that moment. So far, yeah. To see the pride in my students. Because I've taught for 6 years, but I've never seen a group of students proud of something they were doing at school. And so that was the first time I saw kids proud, and that's why that made such an impact on me.
I actually went over there from the junior high to visit that night and talk to all the students, and it was amazing. I mean, these projects these kids came up with were better than, like, high school projects, and I'm being dead honest about that. I mean, they were so well rehearsed and so proud of what they did, and so many parents were there. I think that he only had like 3 kids not show up and 3 parents maybe.
Wow.
Is that right, Todd?
Or? We had 2 kids not show up and over 250 adults.
Yeah, it was insane amount of participation in this. We'll link that to Todd in the show notes.
So okay.
Let's get into just to reiterate, in case there was any questions, the keynote was funny. It was awesome. It was totally genuine. So you did a really great job with that. But
thank you.
One of the things that you were wearing during the keynote was the new Google Glass. I want you to you had those for the week. I'm assuming, right?
I have them. They're upstairs.
Yeah, you still have them. Okay. So let's talk about what are some cool things about Google Glass, and what are some things that maybe are not so cool, or if there is such a thing as not so cool with the Google Glass.
Yeah. Okay. It's, well, first of all, I really like them. You know, I'll caveat this by saying I paid for them, so it's not like I'm a Google shill. I'm not, you know, giving right. you just.
I was going to ask if it was a personal purchase.
Yeah, it was a personal purchase, and you know, it was from that If I Had Glass contest. So they basically choose you to win, and then you buy them, which is a great contest.
So you don't really win. Oh, you just have to pay.
Oh, I win. You feel like you win. You're like, oh, I get to do something cool, and then I get to pay for them, which is weird. Yeah, but anyway, so that's the caveat. I really like them. I think that for me, it's a really great tool. For education, you know, someone just interviewed me the other day about, like, what I thought about the implications of this in education. I think that it's going to be like the iPhone, right? It's going to be all based on the developers and what they come up with. I know that we're working on an app, you know, just very preliminarily, just messing around to see, like, if we could use it for EduClipper in some way. I think it's really great for teachers to get feedback as you go. Like, while that keynote was going on, when I turned off the video, because I videoed the first 10 minutes and then put it on YouTube, but afterwards I was getting direct messages, and I was getting tweets through, you know, the glasses. So it's great for feedback. Teachers, I'm sure, could use that feedback while they're giving a lesson. Like, if a kid has a question, they could ask it very surreptitiously and not interrupt the class and feel awkward or whatever.
So yeah. Do you see that on the little glass piece that's in front of your eye?
Yeah, it looks like, maybe it looks like a 20-inch screen, maybe 10 feet away from you. Like, it's,
wow.
It doesn't look like it, and it's above your eye, so it's not, like, constantly in your field of vision.
Right.
Well, it's in your line of vision, but you know what I mean? It's not obstructing the whole thing. And I really like it. I mean, personally, as a dad, my first week with it, I went to my son's field day, because it was right before SD, and I knew I would be gone for, like, 7 or 8 days. I went to field day, and I'm videotaping most of the stuff through my glasses. And at one point, he comes up to me and gives me a high five and a hug. And you see that perspective on the glass, you know, on that video, and it's unlike anything I've ever seen. If I was holding my iPhone, if I was holding something else, it wouldn't have happened.
So, well, you know, Andrew Van Den Heuvel, he was there too, and he had the Google Glass. And one of the things that he said at the pre-conference before ISTE was that was probably the biggest thing to him about having Google Glass, was that he could just tap the side and take a picture. And so he could just take a picture whenever he wanted with his kids and interact with them, and that they would want to wear them and just take pictures. And he said, as a dad, for him too, that was what he really enjoyed most about the Google Glass.
And that's really what they were created for. They were created to kind of let technology get out of the way. And I know that sounds kind of crazy because they are very invasive looking in some ways, but it really is a really easy thing to wear. Like, I've worn glasses my whole life pretty much, so... You know, for me, it didn't feel like I was wearing anything weird. It's not in the way. The maps is crazy. You know, you can get maps, and as you walk around, it tells you where to go. I live in New York,
wow. Oh, cool.
Honestly, like, walking around the city with those things is really helpful.
How do you wear it with glasses, though? Like, how do you wear Google glasses with your glasses?
I wear contacts with them. But the Google folks do have, like, Warby Parker has some sort of agreement with them. They've made glasses to go with them. I was dying for that, but unfortunately, I'm not that cool. So I'll probably win that opportunity next year.
What is there, like, an operating system similar to, like, iOS on there? I mean, is it similar, like, to the iPhone, or?
It's really like a scaled down Android operating system. Like, there's, you know, Google Now, the cards.
Yes.
It's basically just that. It's cards. Okay. So I can scroll back and see, like, how long it takes me to get to my house. I can scroll forward and see whose birthday it is. I can share the plus. You can do Hangouts on there. To 10 people, up to 10
people.
Oh, wow,
that's cool.
Oh, cool.
Kyle Pace is calling me. I'm wearing a thing, and I tap on it. I'm like, hey, Kyle, what's up, man? Let me go in the bathroom. I'm going to the bathroom with him. And he's like, oh, Adam, I'm here with, like, 30 or 40 administrators. We're broadcasting you onto the screen. I'm in the bathroom.
Thanks.
40 administrators. Awesome. And then the other really neat thing about them is they just added, they're constantly adding stuff, because obviously it's very new technology. They just added Google searches. So you can actually search Google for images, you can search it for web pages, and actually, like, kind of navigate the web with this in your eye, which is really cool. And the only negative, I'll say, is the battery life is really bad.
Oh, is it?
It's, you know, if you're using it a lot, it's maybe 3-4 hours.
Oh, wow. Mm.
So
that'll get better over time.
My battery charger into my pocket with this big wire hanging thing. It charges really fast, if that's any consolation. But yeah. I'm sure they'll get better at that.
Yeah, they'll get better at that.
The weirdest thing is the sound. because there's no speaker on it, but there's this little thing that vibrates on the back of your phone on your ear, and it makes you hear sounds. It's crazy.
Oh, wow.
It's
called a bone conducer or something, condenser or whatever.
It's insane. Yeah.
But honestly, overall, I'm very happy, no buyer's remorse. And to be able to share the experience of what it was like to like just get up in front of that crowd and do that first 10 minutes or so of the keynote, as well as share the experience with people as having something really new, and then capturing that moment of like what it's like for people to try something new, I think it, for me, I'm happy. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Well, moving back a little bit to your keynote, one of the things that made the biggest impact on me listening to that keynote, because I've listened to it several times because it's really inspiring, but the one thing is when you talk about a student you had named Sean. Yeah. And I know some of our listeners here may not have heard the story that you shared from your keynote. Do you mind sharing kind of that story again with us?
No, sure. So I had a student, Sean Riley, who I had in the 10th grade. And, the preface of the story is that I remember, like, my colleague was like, oh, I had him in 9th grade. He really didn't come to school much because he had cancer. He was in remission. He was finally back home. He had cancer. He fought it for, like, 6 months without a school. Came back at the very end of the year. And I remember he was, like, a bit of an attitude. Like, I just remember he was, obviously he was bald from his treatments. I remember he had the Oakley glasses with the MP3 in them. I don't know if you guys remember those from, like, years ago. They were really expensive glasses with the MP3 in there. And he would just, like, jam out, like, Metallica. Like, he was a kid that had gone through something that no kid should go through. And so he did have a little bit of an edge. But I loved that kid. He was great. So I had him in 10th grade, and towards the end of 10th grade, he actually got sick again. So at the 11th grade, I was still his teacher, but he was in and out of school, and that's actually the year that I left to go teach at another school, to be the technology training specialist, rather. But I said that I would stay his teacher for as long as I could. I'll just teach him. He was in the hospital, he was at home, so I would talk to him on the phone, and he said to me, I don't want to read these crappy books. I was like, all right, fine, totally fine. What do you want to do? Like, what would you like to do? And he's like, I'd like to write my life story. And at that point, he was pretty sick. So I was like, sure, let's do that. So we started his life story. He wrote two chapters of his life story in November of 2007. I've gone to visit him at his house. We've gone to visit him in the hospital once. And he and I talked on the phone. We were Facebook friends. So we did a lot of Facebooking back and forth. And then he died like a week later. I just started my job. I remember this because it was like literally the first Friday that I was at this new job. And I remember being like, oh my God, I was a mess. It was just a mess. And then I remember being very nervous because I was like, I have to ask my new employer to take the first Friday off of the job. And you guys know as teachers, that's like, right. It's a hard thing. Right. But I'm like, seriously, like this kid, and they let me. But that was just an awful thing to go through from a class perspective. And the story I tell in the keynote, and what really has happened and is happening, is that Facebook really was this solace for all the kids that I had. The school brought in guidance counselor, they brought in like the grief counselor to talk to, but the reality was that all the students sought each other through Facebook. And literally to this day, people are leaving messages to Sean. I occasionally leave a message to Sean because it's like this cathartic community. We all went through this, and in some ways, I don't know if people, some ways it's like, oh, he'll know, and what came out of that is that this charity 2 years ago was started, I guess it was April of 2012, they started this thing called Sean Lives On, and it's a charity campaign for raising money for kids with cancer, and it was started by students that I had and students that knew Sean, and organized all through Facebook. They just have a fan page, and they take out concert halls, and they get major DJs, and they collect $20. And it's funny because this literally timing is interesting telling the story, because today they announced they're doing another Sean Lives On concert, like a summer concert in August. So that's they're cool. Raising even more money this year. It's like a second concert this year alone, and they're getting big DJs in the area to come and do this. And it's weird to think that my kids are old enough now, that the students that I had at that point are old enough now to go and drink, but all the money goes to charity, so it's all good. But seriously, like it's a wonderful thing. And the first concert, they raised $10,000. Overall, I think they've raised somewhere close to $40,000 now. It's just, you know, it's students doing things that matter, using our tools that we sometimes criticize for being not appropriate for school or not good or whatever, you know, however people want to classify them. But this is really, you know, the power of the media and what students can do with it.
I love that.
And you know, it's I've actually kind of been through that. I haven't had a student in my class that has, you know, passed during when I've had them, but I've had kids that, of course, have, you know, passed that I've known or that were in my class previously. So it's it's a hard thing to go through, and
it really is. It really, I mean, obviously, like cognitively, we all know that it would be, but it's just like, you know, it does hit home. It really does.
Well, and if you're a teacher that makes those connections too and builds those relationships in your class, I mean, those kids become your family. And so, I mean, I can't even imagine losing a student that I currently have in my classroom and then having to deal with that and deal with it with the rest of the students as well. I mean, it's got to be something that, I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine.
Hopefully you won't have to.
Yeah. All right. Tell us a little bit about your Change the World project that you mentioned at ISTE as well.
Sure. So 2010, I got this idea to, I honestly don't remember exactly what it was that was bothering me, but it was something like people saying things like, oh, I can't do this, I'm just a teacher. And I was like, oh, well, what could I do to show people like that small, silly things really can make larger change and add up? So I built this web page with my brother-in-law, and I stuck it on EduTeker. And we particularly kept it separate because people would always say, like, EduTeker is so stylized, like, how do you not make money off of this? And the reality was, is like, I don't. You know, like, it's just the thing. I mean, it was just this separate page that has this penny on it and a little video about why we do this. And basically, when people clicked on the penny, it kept the tally, and I would notice how many pennies were clicked on. And I would donate a penny on the person's behalf to a charity that, right the day after Thanksgiving, I would send out a survey on Facebook and Twitter and through email, and people would vote on where the money should go. And it was like, you know, Make-A-Wish Foundation or March of Dimes or St. Jude's Children's Hospital, and we would donate the pennies. And I got really nervous the first year because I was like, well, it might not be, like, it might not do anything, like, it might not go anywhere. And I guess I wasn't nervous, but I was just kind of like, I would have been upset if that happened. But the first year, it got something like 28,000 clicks.
Wow.
It was pretty cool, you know, from all over the world. Then there was the tsunami that happened in Japan that year. And a teacher contacted me from New Jersey and was like, how do we do the campaign? I'd love to do it. And then Kelly Tinkley was like, I'd love to do that on my website. So she started doing it. So we had like, within the first year, we had maybe four or five schools start doing the same campaign. The next year, we were matched by Google. Edutopia started putting out ads for us and like really raising awareness of the campaign. And you know, we in the last year, I think it was like 120,000 clicks or something like that.
Wow.
Which is good. I mean, it's getting larger and larger, which is the way it's supposed to do. And I actually did it. I did it live, where I gave everyone dollars.
I was going to ask you to share that because I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, it was. You know, it was one of those like last minute ideas. I was like, oh, I want to do this in a major way. So I went to the bank and I was like, can I have like $500 in singles?
That wasn't and suspicious at all.
It was so weird. I remember I was like, oh, they're going to think I'm going to get fur. And then I'm like, they're like, oh, you're going to like a party? I'm like, yeah. In San Diego.
Something like that.
20,000
yeah.
educators. So I had these people stand at the door of the conference, at the room. Thank God it was only 400 people because, like, you know, a lot of money. So we're giving out the dollars. And at the end, I said to people, I'm like, you can keep the dollar and start your own charity campaign with your kids. You can give back the dollar, or you can give back more than the dollar, and then we'll vote on where it goes. And so I guess this is the second time I've cried at ISTE this past year because I remember breaking down a little bit. We collected like almost $800.
Wow.
And people kept the money. Like there were people that tweeted out, there was at least four people that tweeted out like pictures of the dollar and saying like what they're going to do with it. one of them made it into the keynote where it's like, I'm going to use this for a charity campaign that my kids vote on. I'll keep it framed until they decide. And other people have said, I'm going to use this for like my, you know, whatever. And kids have written to me, they've used it to buy prom dresses for kids that couldn't afford it. It's just like one of those things that, like, it is a small act, but it does show that, you know, doing small things really does make a difference. Right. So we're going to keep on doing that. I'm trying to think of bigger and better ways to do it again this year. And, you know, now I think it'll have hopefully a larger reach, but it's a nice way to kind of remind people that, that little stuff adds up.
Right.
So one of your latest projects is EduClipper. So just talk about EduClipper for a little bit. What is it, and you know, what do you see the future for that?
Sure. So EduClipper is my full-time gig right now. It's a way for teachers and students to share on an open social platform. So we have, you know, we're very familiar. I'm sure you guys probably use or at least are familiar with Edmodo and platforms like that that are like these amazing social experiences for your classes. But I think what's missing from that experience is the openness of what it means to really build a community and share. Mm-hmm. So meaning that Edmodo is a great tool, and Schoology and all those other tools are great for building a class experience where you could take down the four walls of the classroom and push learning at the home and really expand on all this stuff. I don't want to do that, you know, like that's being done very well by very big players in the space, and that's fine. But what I did find lacking is that teachers like us are on Twitter, and we're finding great resources, and we're tweeting them out and linking to them and everything. But at least where I'm from in New York, you can't follow your kids on Facebook. You can't tweet them and follow them. You can't, and also, like, they're not all on Twitter. Like, it's hard to get them to sign up. Legally, they can't sign up till 13. You know, they have to really have all these different rules around it. So I was like, well, what if I built a network that was allowing teachers to create buckets of resources and push them to the kids. And instead of just being a clone of other social networks, like everyone compares to the Pinterest, and that's fine, instead of being just the clone with just educational resources, let's build teacher tools. So everything gets cited automatically with EasyGrid that gets taken from the web. And teachers can create groups and differentiate the instruction very easily by saying, like, you know, this group gets this resource, this other group gets another resource, and it's really simple to do that. You can control whether or not your kids get moderated. So do you have to approve the content or no? Can they show their last name in the post? Can they show their avatar? And, you know, and all of this is based on SIP and COPA and all that stuff, but at some point you could override it if you want, you know, because there's work that you can share that's valuable in the community. And there's also filtering and all the, you know, all the normal stuff that comes along with doing social network for schools. But where we're going with it is building out tools for kids to create their own digital portfolios of content. So this community we now have of like 40,000 or 38,000 teachers and 590 classes that have been created already just in the summer months, just in these last 2 months, it's really a platform for classes to build and share resources. Kids can collaborate, kind of like Google Docs, on building resource libraries together. And as I said, we're working towards this idea of making it portfolio-based so you can actually take all the content you're making in class, store it as these clips, and then share it socially. So you'll get feedback from your teacher in a different way that you would get feedback from the community. But you'd still, like, even if it's like a 6-year-old doing an art project or a 7-year-old doing some sort of, like, performance that they videotape and put up, there's feedback. There's positive feedback, there's reinforcement as to what's going on. And you get likes, shares, and comments like every other piece of content on the web. It provides value to the student as opposed to saying, like, oh, B+, good job, which is significantly meaningless.
Can the shares and everything be locked down to a specific class, or is it yep. shared out to the web?
Yes, you could lock everything down to a specific class. Things okay. can be private between classes. By default, when you're young and you sign up by yourself, so there are students on the site that don't have teachers in place with them, there's locks that are put in place as to, like, if you're in third grade and you sign up by yourself, you can only see other third graders' content. So,
a personal question, just for my own sake.
Sure.
Is the video is it all done through YouTube, or is it video that is uploaded to a server somewhere, or how does that work?
So we're launching video when we release the iPad app. Okay. Right now, you can use embed code from YouTube, Vimeo, okay. SchoolTube, and TeacherTube.
Okay. Cool.
You could also use embed code from Prezi and from Blogster and all the other tools that people are using. But when we do the iPad app, which is what we're working on right now, you'll be able to take video and take pictures and upload them, and they'll be stored in either, you know, some sort of cloud solution that is private.
Yeah, so, that sounds like an amazing tool. I'll be honest, I thought it was Pinterest for teachers, and that's not what it sounds like at all. It sounds way better than that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's mainly, well, teachers are the main users now because it is a lot of, like, finding content and sharing content. And the reason we did that intentionally, like, I intentionally built a network that was like that because that's what teachers told me they wanted. We're building a valuable community. And then the idea is to flip the community on its head and say, like, the work that you do is valuable.
Yes,
so we're going to have a lot of teachers sharing lessons and students sharing work as well.
My brain is just running circles right now. It's like that's such a cool tool, and it's exactly what I want in my classroom. So
awesome! Well, if you're using your class, I'm happy to help.
We'll have to break down some doors to get that to happen. But
that's another conversation.
Yeah, we're good at breaking doors. So
it sounds like an amazing tool for even helping teachers, you know, gather resources and helping them integrate technology into their classroom. There's always that group of teachers that has that fear of technology and, you know, and really how to implement it. What advice would you give to those teachers to help them kind of, I don't know, ease into it and kind of lose that fear?
Yeah, and from experience, I know what that's like. Because I was that personality of, like, oh my God, I'm going to use everything, I'm going to do it all right now, and it doesn't work. So, like, my biggest piece of advice that I've given for the last 2 or 3 years, and I'll probably continue giving it for years to come, is that no matter how many tools you learn in one session, because that's usually, like, we have PD once a year, which is unfortunate, right? You have everything crammed into, like, one day or one afternoon or one session, and you learn, like, 100 different things, and the advice is always very simple for me. It's like, use one tool at a time, take the time to really evaluate what worked for your class, and if it doesn't work, don't worry about it. Just use something else or go on. Yeah, I mean, and it's not even about using tool. You know, it's not about the tool necessarily. It's more about, like, if you don't see pedagogically how to make that work, it's not going to work. It's like putting icing on a cake as opposed to, like, really figuring out how to you know, bake it into whatever you're making. So I think that's kind of the idea, is that evaluate the tool, spend a few minutes playing with it beforehand, and if it gets screwed up, don't give up on technology. Just give up on that for the moment, and if it's worth it, you'll come back to it. If not, you just leave it alone.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I actually had a teacher, she's a title specialist, and she at one point thought she was going to get put in the classroom, and just thought it was funny because kind of talking to somebody else, she says, oh my gosh, they're going to put me back in the classroom, and Stacy's going to make me use a smart board.
Well, so, favorite story, you know, it's funny, because my favorite story to tell is about a woman named Loretta, who was retiring. She was a science teacher, and she was retiring, and she made appointments with me every single week, sometimes twice a week, to learn how to do smart board lessons, to learn how to use, like, we had this physics game fun. It was, they'd been bought out by them, but, like, she wanted to know how to use everything. And I said to her one day, I was like, oh, do you want to stop having me come because it's getting towards the end of the year and, like, you're retiring? She's like, no. She's like, I want to be the best teacher my kids will ever have up until the day I'm not here. And I was like, for 60, you know, I think she was like something like 58 or 60 or something like that. And I was like, that's remarkable. You know,
that's,
and
really good, because that's usually the age group where they don't want to get into that.
Well, that's the thing, is, like, I hear that argument a lot. I'm like, you know what? It's not always true. And then there are times where, like, the young people, just because you're on Facebook doesn't mean you know how to use technology well.
Very true. Very true.
You know? You might know how to use Instagram. You can come up with, like, pedagogical valid reasons to do it. You know, like, it's usually that sweet spot of, like, 10 years in the classroom and, like, still open to new things where you get the winners.
Well, one thing we always try to share with our viewers and the guests that we have on is a lesson where you've learned something, maybe a mistake you made while you were in the educational field that really taught you either about yourself or things you would never do again. Is there anything that ever happened to you that really helped mold the way you are today?
Gee, this sounds like a job interview question.
I know.
That is a good job interview question. No, Tom, I've been perfect since day one. No, honestly, more than I mean, we could fill 12 hours with things I did wrong and then realize I did wrong. So I guess one of the things, I'll share two, maybe. I'll share one, and if there's time, I'll share a quick one. You know, my expectations of my students originally, I was not their friend. Like, I had to make them do stuff. And I was really strict. And I think part of it came by the fact that I was young. And part of it came from just the fact that I didn't have teacher credentials for the first 2 years I was teaching. I actually just went back to my master's, I think on the second year that I was in the classroom. And I remember I was very sarcastic with the kids. And I was working with kids that had language-based learning disabilities. And usually what goes along with that is the fact that they don't really get sarcasm. These kids thought I was being literal all the time. And, you know, I had to learn how to talk to students in a way that wasn't familial, that wasn't friendly, but at the same point wasn't like this dictator telling them what to do. And I think that it was really, you know, a strong lesson to learn. And it's a fine line. Like, a lot of people fall into the trap of, like, being a friend or being, like, the dictator. Mm-hmm. And I think that finding that middle ground was really helpful, not only in talking to my students in years to come, but also in talking to everybody. You know, like how do I talk to groups of teachers when I do trainings? And how do I talk to people that work with me? You know, I have employees. I don't want to talk to them like they're, you know, servants of some kind. They're teammates. And that's how I started treating everybody, as a teammate. Because I think that whether you're an educator or an administrator or if you're a student in the class, like, you really are part of the same team. So I think that was one of those lessons I learned. It's not giving you, like, how badly I messed it up, because there were times where, like, the principal of the school would call me and be like, they don't get sarcasm. Like, being funny is perceived as being rude. And I'm like, oh, gotcha. And it took a while for me to get that, but it definitely was a lesson worth learning. And the other one I'll show very quickly is I listened to what people said a lot in the terms of, like, administrators, because they were the administrator, and I stopped doing that. And it's not an easy thing to do, but I started doing what I felt was right for people. And what I'm saying, the mistake was, is I just listened to people blindly. The administrator would say, you have to do this. And I'd be like, okay. And I'd do it. I wasn't happy about it, but I'd do it anyway. And then it just got to the point where I was like, you know what? That's not the right thing to do. Like, regardless of what I'm told to do, it's just not the right thing for the students, for what's going on in the classroom. It's just, you know, they're not in there. And that's not an easy one, but I think it's one that we all have to deal with in some ways and make, you know, kind of live with the decisions that we make. So I said in the keynote, actually, the line was almost like a throwaway, but it really could have been like this long thing about, you know, our inactions speak as loudly as our actions. So we have to choose, you know, I think very, very carefully what we give in on and what we stand up for. So there's two things I've learned, and trust me, to fill books and volumes of other things that I've messed up and then try to come back.
I think we all do.
Yeah, well, that's how you learn things, right?
Exactly.
So in the ed tech world, things are kind of changing, like, literally every day. What's one of the things, just kind of to go out on, that you're really super passionate about right now in maybe the ed tech world?
I think access is really exciting to me. You know, like, the fact that we're moving away from what platform do you have, like, with the, you know, and this has been happening for a while, like the BYOD thing and mm-hmm. Just the fact that devices are so inexpensive. I think that we're coming to a point very rapidly where kids will have access to things. Now, network, being, you know, hopefully the government is working on this hard, and you know, we'll get that working for us, I guess, in the next 2 years. But I love the fact that kids have access to devices everywhere. You know, I work in some of the poorest districts in the country, and the kids all seem to have devices where they can get on, or are resourceful enough to get devices that they can get on, and they're all creating stuff. I mean, the devices have gotten better. So from a technology standpoint, like, I'm very passionate about the fact that you can create on anything. You know, I've seen really good projects on dumb phones with cameras, you know, and let alone the apps that are making it so you can edit movies in your phone, and you could do, like, full you know, musical compositions, you know, from a tablet or whatever. I mean, it's just remarkable how much stuff we have that allows us to create. We've gone, you know, the biggest argument when the iPad came out, right, was it was a consumer device. And unfortunately, a lot of people used it that way. But the fact is like, developers, and some of those developers are kids, are realizing how to make these tools into creation devices. And that's what's exciting to me, is like we're making new stuff. You know, we're not just consuming the garbage that the big publishers are feeding us. We're creating our own textbooks. We're creating, you know, like kids are making their own videos explaining different things that go on in science and math and all sorts of stuff. So it's an exciting time to be a learner.
Definitely.
Definitely.
And a teacher. It's an exciting time to be a teacher, too, when we're teaching this.
One in the same.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, Adam,
still
I mean,
students.
Well, Adam, I mean, we want to thank you for coming on with us today.
My pleasure.
It's been great to listen to you and hear your story again and just to kind of get to sit and chat with you for a little bit. Do you want to go ahead and shoot out your Twitter, your website, I mean, all those kind of things real quick?
Oh, sure. It's my Twitter is at Adam Bello. The websites are Edutecher, EDUTECHER, and Educlipper, EDUCLIPPER.net. And those are the Twitter handles for that. You can just Google me. People will find me.
And we'll have all those links on our website as well so they can find all that information. But for those of you who are listening, thank you again for listening. You can find us on Twitter at EDU All Stars HQ. You can check out our blog and some of the old podcasts that we've done at eduallstars.com. And if you go on iTunes and search EDU All Stars, one word, no spaces, you can find our podcast there as well. We want to just thank you again, Adam and Stacey.
We've been able to speak to some amazing people. So everybody that's listening, make sure you go back and you check the archives and check the website so that you can go back and listen to those people as well and get all of the info on people that are coming up.
And I say this at the end.
Thank you guys for having me, honestly.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Really fun to talk about you guys.
And if you guys have made it this far, we hope you appreciate the show. It would be extra appreciated if you were able to go and leave a rating on iTunes for it. Those ratings actually affect how Apple promotes the show, and we've seen a substantial number of downloads just from being in the new and noteworthy and having, you know, a bunch of people downloading the show and leaving ratings. So if you could do that for us, it'd be super appreciated, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again.